Welcome to This Week in Money. I'm Jim Goddard. Today, Ross Clark from chartsandmarkets.com runs down the major markets. Are we seeing hints of a possible stock market correction? Ross takes a look at gold and crude. Publisher of Rick's Picks, Rick Ackerman, comments on how little money is actually being put into the stock markets, whether debt is the elephant in the room, and gives us some targets for what have been hot stocks. Founder of thetrendletter.com, Martin Straith, believes there's no way the U.S. government could ever pay down its debt, and that's why he doesn't believe in long-term government bonds. He tells us about China and Germany's struggling economies and what that means here. We'll talk to Ross Clark right after this.
Recyclical, making lithium ion last forever. Recyclico's patented recycling process achieves up to 100% recovery of battery metals from lithium-ion batteries for electric vehicles, including cobalt, lithium, nickel, manganese, and aluminum. Recyclico Battery Materials Incorporated trades on the TSX Venture AMY, on the OTCQB AMYZF, and Frankfurt ID4. For more information, visit recyclico.com or phone us at 778-574-4444. Recyclico, making lithium ion last forever.
Welcome to This Week in Money, the source for market opinions. Here is Jim Goddard.
My guest is Ross Clark from chartsandmarkets.com, where you'll find insightful market commentary and timely technical analysis. You can find him on Twitter at chartsbyross. Welcome back to This Week in Money.
Always a pleasure, Jim.
Ross, what's going on the markets? They seem a little choppy over the week.
They really tried this week to keep things together. Even on Friday, after the employment numbers came out, markets rallied a little bit through the first half of the day. But, you know, by the close, here we are down across the board. So for the week, the Dow was the best index of the big ones, down 1%. But S&P was down 2%. The NASDAQ was down 3%. And this is the first week since the middle of March where we've actually had a week with a lower low, and well, that plus the fact that we closed below last week's low. So momentum really started to dissipate about 2 or 3 weeks ago, and now it's rolled over, and we're starting to see the erosion process. So, you know, we've gone for quite a ways without a correction. Originally, we were thinking, you know, the 20-day moving average would be good for a first bounce, and we've seen that in a lot of the stocks. But now it looks as though, you know, the deeper correction, which is sort of a classic, when you get into July, August, you're going to get a bit of a rollover, and September, probably second half September into early October, is where the bargains can be found. So you don't want to be too aggressive in here. And you know, if you take a look around for rotation in terms of where the money is flowing, clearly the high-tech stocks, for all that they had fabulous runs, most of them are losing their momentum. And you know, you look at the Nvidias and the Metas, they don't seem to have too much left in there. Apple was really the big one of the week. Ended up down 7% on the week, had a really bad day on Friday after the earnings, and I guess not selling as many phones as they used to. You've got to come out with something really fantastic in your new products to get people to spend $1,000. And it's, what, been maybe, what, 3 years since there was any big innovations as far as phones were concerned. So, you know, a time for a little bit here of a pause without a question. And, you know, the deeper the correction here, you know, the better the bargains are when we get out into September, October.
What's going on with gold?
Gold market and silver market sold off during the week. They ended up having a mildly, you know, down week by the close. But this was after a nice reversal on Friday. The gold tested the 19.25 level. The modeling we've been working with was that there would be a couple of sell-offs off that March high. So the first one got down to 1900, at the end of June. Nice bounce, and then a retest of that low in this week. I'd like to see maybe one more drive to the downside, take out a bit of support that we have right here. The commitment of traders numbers, there's nothing big in there. If we could see a bit of a clean out, that would really help the bullish case scenario. But August for the modeling looked like it would be a low for gold, and maybe we've got the first test of that now, and as we move through the month, we'll look at it a little more aggressively. We did get some good oversold readings on Wednesday and Thursday, and that was coupled with the U.S. dollar index having had a pretty good move there as well. We had rallied from 99.5 up to 102 a week ago, and by the time we got to the middle of this week, the dollar index was getting overbought just as the precious metals were getting oversold. So the reversal in the dollar to the downside is all part and parcel with the bounce that we saw in precious metals. Some of the signals we look at in here had nice signals 2 days before the top in the dollar index. And usually you can see a pretty good correction off that. I think that maybe where the index is around 102 right now, anything 101 or lower is where the next support level is that could be tested.
Anything going on the energy front?
We're getting a really good move here. So the crude oil market, as we mentioned here a week ago, has had that breakout of the moving averages after the bottom at 68. By the time we got through to 73, things were starting to look pretty bullish as far as the basing was concerned. And by the end of this week, we've been up through $82 and managing to hold that. The rally, when we look at these historical bottoms in the oil market, and this is the sixth one of this style going back through the last four decades, typically this will rally until we get what we call a sequential 9-sell setup on the weekly chart. So once we've had 9 consecutive weeks above 4 weeks earlier, then we can be looking for a pretty good correction in the oil market. And at this point, we've just finished the fifth week in that setup phase. So you're probably looking at maybe, the better part of August as having an upside bias before we're ready for a decent correction to the downside. But with the type of bottom we've got in here, of the five previous ones like this, four of them continued on for multi-month rallies. We had one that faltered after this initial rally and then sat around and just thrashed around for the better part of a few months. But four out of the five had a correction and then went back on to put in higher highs.
Ross, thank you so much for the update.
And always good to be with you, Jim.
My guest has been Ross Clark from chartsandmarkets.com. Find him on Twitter at chartsbyross. Coming up, we'll be speaking with Rick Ackerman next on This Week in Money.
Always consult your investment professional before making any investment decision. Don't miss out. Stay informed. Receive the HowStreet.com weekly recap with thought-provoking podcasts, radio, and articles delivered to your inbox. Sign up for the HowStreet.com weekly recap on our homepage at HowStreet.com. This Week in Money is archived online at TalkDigitalNetwork.com.
Welcome back. My guest is Rick Ackerman, editor of the newsletter Rick's Picks, his website rickackerman.com. Welcome back to This Week in Money, Rick.
Thanks again. I always appreciate the chance to connect with your guys.
You mentioned this bull market is consuming almost no capital as it moves higher. Can you explain that?
Yeah, it's a fraud. There's no question. And you would think that that when a market keeps going up and up and up, that it reflects bullish buying interest. but it's not really. It's sort of more like bullish, or it's more like cynical maintenance of the rally. And the way it works, and you can see this on Apple's chart, maybe three quarters of the time, 75% of the days of the week, the stock will gap open the first bar of the day. So let's say that Apple has traded at 182 on Thursday, and on Friday, because there's some buying interest that is pent up overnight, it opens at 185. And effectively, no stock has changed hands in that $3 range. It's just that, you know, the specialists are flooded with bids in the morning, and they have the leeway to put the stock anywhere they want, where they think they can reasonably satisfy all immediate demand. So the exchange lets them take the stock price up to 185, and that's where they fill everybody. A lot of times it's a bull trap. They take it down, but presumably when Apple's falling, including today when it's down almost 3%, it's just a hoax. It's guys that, they've shorted stock at their own targets, and they're just simply planning to reacquire it at lower levels. But the gap openings really just push stocks up, and it's not just Apple. It happens in Microsoft, Chipotle, you know, the whole bunch of what I call the lunatic sector stocks, but they're completely manipulated, and the institutions don't really do anything but buy and hold, and they do take them higher on these short covering gaps that occur in the morning. And it's a big piece of the wealth effect, because on some days, you know, Apple being a $3 trillion stock, when they gap it up $4, $5, $6, you're talking about adding literally hundreds of billions of dollars to the macro ledger. So, you know, in the Fed's way of looking at it, and the way that most of the chimpanzees who have degrees in economics look at it, that's wealth. But it's not. It's just it's absurdly inflated stock prices that act that way on a basis of a manipulation.
Is there a purely technical case for significantly higher prices?
Well, technical in the sense that I see it. I like to look at the charts and let them tell me what is. I don't trust my own judgment, especially at major turning points, but the charts are always going to be right. And I've got a few world beater stocks, Apple, Chipotle, Microsoft, and you can see they're definitely going higher. In Chipotle's case, before it crossed the 2000 threshold, I had a technical target at 2700. And even though the stock has come down pretty hard since mid-July from about, 2150, close to 2200, traded a recent low down below 1900. So it's come down a bit. But when you look at the long-term chart, the weekly, I have, at least according to my method, a very, very strong case for the stock going to 2700. And Microsoft, similarly, has a substantially higher target, and so does Apple, which, as I mentioned, is getting sold down hard today. So the idea is that as long as these crucial stocks, kind of no-brainers that the chimps use to, you know, to park your hard-earned money, as long as they're going higher, we're not going to have a bear market. And of course, no one could find more reasons for this, for a bear market to be in progress right now. But again, I just want to pay attention, look at my charts and trust them.
Could the stock markets run higher into 2024, 25, or even 2026?
Well, nothing's impossible. And, you know, when you go back maybe a year, or a little more than a year, and you see nothing but bleak earnings for Microsoft and a couple of other biggies, they pushed the market higher anyway. You know, what happened was all those stocks got oversold into expectations of bum earnings reports, and the bum outlooks came, but the stocks were already sold out, so that the sleazeball chimps who run the show, they were able to run the stocks back up on short covering. So that's how the impossible, the seemingly impossible, is achieved. And of course, you never want to connect up a time frame or or a big rally with coordinates in the real world. It doesn't really matter what the earnings are or anything else, so whether we're it's not going to beat a recession, but of course the market going up in and of itself wards off recession because it creates this psychological climate that whatever's wrong with the economy, how bad can it be if the stock market is pushing up toward new highs?
Interest rates are climbing again. Do you think we could see double digit interest rates?
No, it's virtually impossible. Almost impossible anyway. I put out a headline target of 5.5% on the 10-year. This was not too long ago. The 10-year rate at the time was 3.79%. So I was basically saying we had room for whatever it was, maybe a 30 to 40% increase in rates. But and what that told me also is that even though I've been a hardcore deflationist since forever, that this deflation that is inevitable in my mind it's not coming really until interest rates have topped. Because if interest rates are at 5.5% and it hasn't already deflated the economy into a debt bust, that implies we must be having more inflation until that time.
What are you seeing in the housing market?
There's no way out of an absolute collapse. You know, just go to California and try to buy a home, even though everybody's fleeing the state. It's a Wile E. Coyote thing where the prices are still hovering up there. San Francisco is a particularly egregious case. You know, it's the neighborhoods, what you might refer to the body, have been severed from the head. San Francisco is going into a death spiral, but property values are holding up simply because nobody's selling homes. You know, they're sort of hunkering down. And of course, the three or four boom and bust cycles they've had in San Francisco have, in this case, wrongly instructed homeowners, don't worry, prices will come back. But San Francisco is just a great example of how the extremely low transaction volume in residential housing, and I don't mean just in San Francisco or California, it's really across the U.S. There's so few houses changing hands that you have a thin, very illiquid market that reflects something other than the market price. And of course, a lot of the baby boomers don't have to sell. They would like to downsize, but they don't have to sell. They can sit tight, and eventually that has to be reconciled. You know, the baby boomers' properties have to be passed in some way to the next generation that won't even be able to afford to pay taxes on them because they'll be too busy paying off student loans for their art history degrees.
Is the U.S. dollar under pressure?
Obviously. I mean, it's come down like crazy. And you know, in all the years that I've sort of had this deflationary prediction out there, and I do think deflation is absolutely unavoidable as a consequence of debt that we can no longer repay. There's just got to be a debt bust. And I can, you know, go into the hyperinflation case, but it doesn't really hold water. All right, so the dollar has been under pressure, and that's hardly a sign of incipient deflation. And I think the dollar has to keep coming down. But even though it's come down quite a bit, you know, we had a high back in the fall of 2022 of 115 in the dollar index, and we had a recent low that just dipped below 100. So the dollar has had a pretty ferocious sell-off since late 2022. But keep in mind that sell-off is in the context of a bull move that took the dollar in mid-2021 from a low of around, 88 or so. Let's see, 2021, the low was 89 up to 115. So we've only corrected that by half so far, maybe slightly less than half. So the extreme weakness in the dollar should be seen as corrective.
Do you expect gold and silver to go for a run higher anytime soon?
No, they're in the most slack, the most disappointing
bull market that I can imagine. You know, this is nothing like the 1970s where gold went bonkers and, you know, even Time magazine had business section stories about gold. It's definitely in a bull market, but it's in no hurry. And so it's just full of disappointments. It's come down pretty hard since last May when price of COMEX gold topped above 2100. So we're down at 1959, and it's just kind of marking time. And eventually it will go higher, much higher, but it will be congruent with a complete systemic change. I'm going to use the word collapse, and we just haven't had that. You know, gold has at this point no catastrophe to discount or no imminent catastrophe, so it's just kind of screwing the pooch.
Is debt the elephant in the room?
No, it is the room. It's more than just the elephant, and there's just no getting around it. We've come back to something C.V. Myers wrote back in the 1970s in his book, The Coming Deflation. He was a bit early on a prediction, but the basis of it was elemental, and that is that in the end, every penny of every debt must be paid, if not by the borrower, then by the lender. So, for instance, when you forgive $1.8 trillion of student debt, which we've wisely decided not to do, it's not that the debt is going away. The bondholders who financed the students' art history degrees will be stuck with the loss. And the deflation takes place, it happens in much more insidious ways, such as, for one, you know, the in the 1970s, 80s, where women began to leave the home to go into the workplace, in most instances because they had to. And we're going to see the effects of deflation. We're seeing them now in a pretty pronounced way in medical care. It's not like prices have gone up. The availability of medical care is in a triaging process. And if you can't look, it's what's, you know, we're getting a lot less medicine because we can't afford it. And so you might say that we're having deflation in medicine, although it's not a monetary inflation. It's one that bears on the amount of service we get. So if you can't see that, anybody who can't see that in the latest big idea, which is telemedicine, you're blind, really, because we're going to reach a point for sure. The baby boomers are not going to get the level of care that our parents did, the greatest generation. We're not going to get all these replacement hips and shoulders and bypass operations. And perhaps at some point, like Canada, they're going to say, well, you're just not going to get that procedure because you're too old. And when your pacemaker battery runs out, you'll simply have to die. And that's what it is in Canada right now. But in the U.S., we are slowly eliminating care. We're winnowing it down. And that is a sort of subterranean effect of deflation.
Something my little sister, who works at a co-op store in northern Alberta, noticed is that older people now are paying for their purchases with currency that was printed back in the 80s, the 70s, in some cases the 60s. In other words, they're dipping into their secret stock of cash that they've hidden around the house. Is that a phenomenon in the U.S. as well? People are trying to dig up assets to pay bills.
I don't think we're quite that hard pressed yet in the U.S., but that is interesting, you know, and I would say that people do that. You say, well, why don't you just take it out of the mattress and put it in your checking account if you're going to spend it anyway? And to me, the logical reason is that people still think of that shoebox full of money as for an emergency, a rainy day. And of course, once they put it in their checking account, the idea of savings is completely lost. So they're sort of hanging on to that, the illusion that they've got savings.
Your thoughts on the share price of Apple?
Apple's going to get crushed at some point. It's getting mini crushed today, But there's, with all of the overpriced hardware and Apple's inability to innovate its way out of a wet paper bag, it's very vulnerable in an economic downturn. You know, iPhones are a hugely discretionary item, and that's I mean, globally, it's not just the U.S. So in hard times, the very pumped up Apple, and you know, there's no denying they sell a hell of a lot of iPhones, but they don't have much else, and they're kind of telling the world that when they come out with a $3,500 pair of you know, made a world goggles or something, that they're clueless about where to take things next. So fortunately, they still have very robust sales of iPhones globally, but that's going to be very different when people are not feeling quite so rich, you know, so fat that they can buy a new iPhone every 2 years.
Was Fitch right to downgrade the U.S. government's credit rating?
I would say they're wrong to have not just downgraded it in a way that's commensurate with the actual, with the debt problems. I mean, we are so far, if the downgrades acknowledge reality, the state of Illinois, for one, wouldn't even be able to borrow, but they still do. And of course, the government and all the state governments at all levels are easily able to borrow, but that's going to change.
Is San Francisco a city in decline?
The horrifying thing about San Francisco is that even though it's declined to an appalling degree, the decline has only just begun. You know, San Francisco is so far off hitting the bottom. And, you know, I lived there for 20 some years, and I have two siblings who both live there. They're a little bit in denial about what's happening. And I have to say that apparently the one competent, non-corrupt administrator in all of San Francisco government happens to be the guy responsible for Golden Gate Park. So with him and a little bit of an infusion of Silicon Valley money, Golden Gate Park has been not only well maintained, but it's been upgraded in some ways. So the park is still a wonderful amenity, and all the neighborhoods, the Sunset and the Richmond and Noe Valley. Well, I'm not sure about Noe Valley, but it's not like you have all of the homeless sleeping in those neighborhoods. And of course, in some of the better neighborhoods like Pacific Heights, Russian Hill, a call to the police will bring out someone who will get rid of the guy who's pitched a tent in front of the gate to your home. So it's really frightening when you think that San Francisco, the decline hasn't even begun. And we get a sense of that when the clueless are discussing the possibility of transforming the high-rise towers into residences, and that's maybe the stupidest idea I've ever heard. And but just to sort of appreciate it from a somewhat of an abstract point of view, if those towers are filled up with people living there instead of just working there from 9 to 5, forget about the energy inputs that would require and, you know, and the expense of it, meaning you'd only have wealthy people living in the buildings. If it were otherwise and there were poor people living in subsidized housing, picture them exiting in the morning and ask yourself, well, where are they going? You know, they're not going anywhere. There are no jobs. You got to conceivably, or in the imagination of these morons who think about, who even talk about converting the high rises into, you know, the business towers like Salesforce.com's building into residences. You got no economy there to support the population. It would just be sort of the projects, recalling the days of the 1960s and 70s, Pruitt-Igoe in St. Louis and Cabrini-Green in Chicago. Well, this is going to make Cabrini-Green look like a little village square. And it's coming. You know, even Salesforce.com is not the tenant in its own building. The building was built simply because, you know, when your stock has a valuation in hundreds of billions of dollars, you can spread that phony inflated wealth around and say, well, okay, we'll lay out $3 billion to build a completely unnecessary, superfluous headquarters in San Francisco, and there are quite a few of them. It's not just Salesforce.
What about the rampant inflation San Francisco was seeing? People were talking about $50, $60 burgers not long ago, and that turned them off from going back there again for holidays.
Yeah, somebody told me about a $50 truffle burger there on Valencia Street in the Mission, and no doubt it was true. That's got to change because, you know, these emptied out office buildings mean that all the slackers and the tech sector, they're no longer coming to work. So so the indigenous population in San Francisco, they're going to be poor, they're going to be fewer tech workers, and therefore fewer $50 truffle burgers on offer. But I have to say, the regular burger, the bar burger, is catching up. You know, it's not uncommon to get a $25 burger in something other than a Valencia Street bistro.
Oh, yeah. The pubs here now are charging that for their food. And calamari, $22 for 6 squid rings.
Yeah, it's pretty amazing. I mean, they even ding you for chicken wings now. I mean, it's $12 just for a few of them, and chicken wings, they may as well give you the option of substituting gizzards for less.
I was going to say, and it looks like some of the chickens were starved to death by the small size of the wings.
Yeah, that's scrounged chicken.
Mm-hmm. What's the take on China's economy? Because I read a story where parents, instead of buying liquid milk for their kids, now are buying powdered milk because that's all they can afford.
Well, at least that's not water on their cornflakes. You know, they're one step removed. We never really have a clear view of what's happening in China. It was sort of like trying to figure out what was happening in Russia in the 1950s against an 8% GDP growth number. So China is very mysterious. We do know that they had quite a bit of real estate speculation there. I mean, the Chinese in China have the same attitude toward real estate as you see around in your neighborhood in Vancouver. There's always been this thing about, well, if you own property, you can never go wrong. So in desperation, obsession with the owning property, a lot of investment in Chinese real estate went into places that were unfinished businesses. There was no plumbing, no electrical, but they owned themselves a nice little condo shell. And Chinese savings go deep enough that they managed to absorb it without collapsing 10 years ago. But I think it's going to take a collapse in the world that China exports to bring about China's own downfall.
And, of course, Beijing itself has had massive flooding. The footage of cars being swept down the street, absolutely incredible.
Really, I've tuned out the news mostly in avoidance of the sordid local news, but that's too bad.
Why are the odds of Kamala Harris becoming president not as poor as most people would like to imagine?
Right, we would like to think that someone so stupid and horrible that even most Democrats don't like could never get elected, but unfortunately, I think she's likely to be the sitting president before 2024. They can only keep Biden on ice for so long, and there's no protocol really for tossing out Kamala if she's the vice president. And even if she's only the vice president, it's still, from a political standpoint and going through the conventions and all that, it's a difficult job. It's a real task to somehow swap in Gavin Newsom, who I think would be an awesome candidate, running on his record of having destroyed California. You know, that's what Democrats seem to go for. So, but to swap in Newsom, just from the standpoint of protocols and procedure, it's very difficult. So, and Biden has given proof to the idea that it doesn't really matter who you represent as president, who you sort of put up there, as long as someone's pulling the strings, it'll work just fine. But it does leave one, and this would, I hope, include Democrats, wishing that we had a president that could get up and speak in front of people without embarrassing himself to the whole world.
What are your thoughts on RFK Jr.?
Well, every time I tell a friend, a conservative friend, I kind of like the guy, they give me chapter and verse about how he's not really one of us. But he does make such sense when he talks certainly about vaccines and the, you know, let's say just one aspect of it, the thimerosal preservative, and links it to a known fact that mercury that's in thimerosal is 100 times more toxic than lead in whatever way we ingest it, you know. So he makes a lot of sense, and I'd have to say I would much rather an RFK with a lot of misguided liberal ideas be in charge than Kamala Harris or any other Democrat.
Will Michelle Obama run for president?
She'd never done a damn thing in her life, really, and you got to read her Princeton thesis, you know, word for word, before you realize that it started a long time ago. And I think how could she be unhappy with all the perks that came with it? You know, the house and the flights with her whole entourage, the vacations, and that's what she's got. She's got a really cushy life. And she must know that the presidency is a difficult job. She's a very lazy person, and I don't think she could be. It's going to take a lot of pushing to get her into the list of nominees. Or there won't be a list at that point. You know, in order to just talk her into it, they'd have to say you're our single choice. You're not going to have to compete against anybody. Just say you'll run. So I don't know. I guess it's kind of a. I wouldn't call it a coin toss exactly. But I'm not sure how I would handicap it. But I think that she is very seriously resistant to the idea of running for presidency when everything's just so conky-dory in her life otherwise.
Anything else you think we should be keeping a close eye on right now?
Oh, I think we've covered everything in the world, Jim, in the world of of appalling possibilities anyway. I always like to, on the bright side, not terribly bright, but I always like to mention my friend Charles Hugh Smith, who he's just my favorite blogger, and he keeps talking about how self-sufficiency is the answer, even to the extent of living off the land, which at this point he is almost literally doing in Hawaii. So I would say that his advice, cultivate your garden, literally, is what we should all be doing. And of course, there are the satisfactions of doing that besides it's producing food that you can eat. So I think there's a brighter future for anyone with, as Charles would put it, a plan C.
Rick, thank you so much for speaking with us. And how can people find out more about Rick's Picks?
Well, I'm glad you asked, Jim. If they go to rickackerman.com, just click on the free trial subscription. You'll have access to everything, a chat room where I routinely throw out random trades, including one in Apple last week, a bull trade that made a subscriber about $14,000 in 20 minutes. Today we've got a nice trade going on in TLT that some of my subscribers are doing, and it's up very nicely. So a good place to get trading ideas that will allow the letter to pay for itself. Again, rickackerman.com. Just go up to the menu up top and click on free trial.
My guest has been Rick Ackerman, editor of the newsletter Rick's Picks. His website, rickackerman.com. Coming up, Martin Straith, next on This Week in Money.
Recyclico, making lithium-ion last forever. Recyclico's patented recycling process achieves up to 100% recovery of battery metals from lithium-ion batteries for electric vehicles, including cobalt, lithium, nickel, manganese, and aluminum. Recyclico Battery Materials Incorporated trades on the TSX Venture AMY, on the OTCQB AMYZF, and Frankfurt ID4. For more information, visit recyclico.com or phone us at 778-574-4444. Recyclico, making lithium-ion last forever.
This Week in Money is archived online at talkdigitalnetwork.com.
Welcome back. My guest is Martin Strathe, founder of Trend News Online at thetrendletter.com. He's speaking to us from Coquitlam, BC, just east of Vancouver. Welcome back to This Week in Money.
Well, thank you, Jim. Good to be here.
Martin, Fitch just downgraded the U.S. government's credit rating to AA+ from AAA, and only the second time in history the U.S. has been downgraded. Is this serious?
Well, I think it's telling. The U.S. is not going to default on their debt, at least not now. But, you know, some of the comments that Fitch made, you know, they talked about, you know, the expected fiscal deterioration over the next few years and about the high and growing general government debt burden. And they talked about the repeated, you know, debt limit standoffs and the last minute resolutions. You know, we talked last month about how the U.S. government had spent a bunch of money since the debt ceiling standoff was settled. I just took a look. This is up to the end of July. So from the debt ceiling agreement, so that was, I think it was June 2nd, to the end of July, so it's 41 business days. So in that period of time, the U.S. government has now added $1.33 trillion to their debt. So that's over $32 billion per day. And this last week, the U.S. Treasury just announced that they need to boost their borrowing to $1.03 trillion from now to the rest of the year. So the U.S. debt, again, it's like $32.6 trillion. So that's $97,500 per person, $253,600, I think it is, per taxpayer. And it was very interesting. I was reading Yahoo News when this announcement came out, and their headline was, you know, it had the fixed comment and the downgrading, and then the headline was likely to be ignored in Washington. And that's really the story. You know, they just keep spending more money than they have, and, you know, they keep adding to this close to $33 trillion debt. But I think this downgrade really highlights what most people already knew, you know, that the U.S. is a mess fiscally, you know, with their massive deficits and debt. Plus, I mean, look at the political situation in the U.S. I mean, they're so polarized, nothing gets done. And, you know, they got an election coming up, and it looks like it's going to be Trump and Biden again for the 2024 election. I mean, and, you know, and Trump might be in prison then, so that'll be interesting. But, you know, a key point to me is that the U.S. debt is so large that it can never be paid off. I mean, you know, we're talking over $95,000 per person. I mean, it's never going to happen. It's not sustainable. You can't do that. So we've got U.S. tensions with China, and we've got China being the second largest holder of U.S. bonds. So what's interesting to me is that China has now been selling their bonds, the U.S. bonds, at a very rapid rate. So in June of 2022, so a little over a year ago, China held $941 billion of U.S. bonds. Today, they own $846 billion. So they sold almost $100 billion in the last year. And they're continuing to sell at an accelerated pace now. So this is significant because what we've told our subscribers is do not hold any long-term government bonds. And that implies to Canada as well, because at some point we're going to have a global debt crisis. You know, short-term government bonds, you know, are fine. I mean, they're actually a great conservative investment right now. You know, 6 months is getting a 5.5%. You know, the Canadian 1 year is getting 5.4, I believe it is. So as investors, I mean, this news is, you know, all the commentators will kind of push it aside. And it in itself is not a big deal. But it, to me, what it does is it's just reminding us what the situation is. This, you know, the U.S. is the biggest economy in the world. So just be wary as an investor of long-term government bonds. So we're talking 10-year, especially 20 and 30-year.
Now, the Fed raised rates as expected to 5.5% last week. Will they be cutting rates by the end of the year?
I wouldn't think so. You know, unless, of course, something really, really terrible happens in the economy. I mean, the Fed hiked rates for, what, the 11th time last week? So, as you say, 5.5%. So now it's at the highest Fed rate since, was it January 2001, I think. So now we've got monetary policy in the U.S. It's the highest we've seen since August 2007. So the U.S. inflation rate is 3%. The U.S. Fed rate's now 5.5%. So that means that the real rate is now a positive 2.5%. So it's basically the Fed rate minus the inflation rate. In Canada, inflation is 2.8. Bank of Canada is 5. So we've got a real rate of 2.2. So now we've got both countries have an interest rate of over 2% higher than the inflation rate. So we need to remember that these lower inflation numbers are on top of last year's very high inflation numbers of, was it 9.1% in the U.S. and 8.3% in Canada. So, you know, if you combine that, you know, over the last 2 years, U.S. inflation is up 12.1%. Canada is up 11.3%. So I would expect both of these central banks would pause for a while, you know, unless, of course, they see inflation rising higher, and then they'll probably raise rates again. Now, if the economy takes a hit, such as a recession, that would change things. So interesting today, we just saw weaker jobs data in both Canada and the U.S. Now, of course, this data from these government sources is so unreliable. It's really hard to have any confidence that they portray an accurate picture of the jobs or economy in general. But that's the numbers we get. They always miss the estimates by just a wide margin. So even if the economy starts to slow, I would really doubt the Bank of Canada or the Fed would cut rates for a while now. Now, of course, you know, talking the U.S. side of it, you know, there isn't an election next year. So there's going to be some really big political pressure on the Fed to cut rates.
If a recession would be the reason to cut rates, what would be a likely reason for them to raise rates further?
Oh, well, I mean, the key to me would be energy costs. You know, energy prices were a huge factor in the high inflation numbers we saw last year. And you remember last year in the Q2, oil prices were about $108. You know, this year they've been averaging about $74. So the drop of inflation this year is nothing to do with government actions or policies. It's largely to do with the global energy price decline. You know, in Canada, the energy prices accounted for about 70% of the decline in inflation. So that from 8.3 down to 2.8 this year. So now recently, since late June here, the oil has been trading from a low of 67, and it's jumped up about 21% now. And so today, what have we got here? It's 82.6. So it's $82.60. So if oil prices keep rising from here, we could see the Bank of Canada and the Fed keep rates higher for longer.
Well, I certainly remember last September, gasoline in Vancouver was $2.67 a liter. That's $10.68 per Canadian gallon. That's a bit of money.
It's a bit of money. And what is it today? About $1.95 or something?
Yeah.
So, and even that's pretty outrageous. But, you know, like you say, compared to almost $2.70, that has an effect.
Why have Fed rate hikes not hurt most Americans?
Well, I mean, I think it's certainly hurt many of them, especially the lower and middle class with food and housing. But to your point, I mean, one of the key reasons that the U.S. economy is so strong is that only 11% of U.S. households have a debt with an adjustable or variable interest rate. So what it means is most Americans have fixed rate mortgages and loans. So their payments have not gone up, at least not yet. But if the rates remain high, then these borrowers are going to get hit when their mortgage or loans come up for renewal. I just saw an article this week noting that in Canada, 65% of mortgages will be coming due by the end of 2024. So if the rates stay high, a lot of these households are going to get impacted by these higher rates over the next year.
Yeah, we just had to renegotiate a mortgage, and it was 1.96, and now it's 7.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, I know. I mean, my daughter and all their friends, the exact same thing. They think they're at 1.8 something, and they're coming due next year. So, yeah, it's going to bite.
While inflation is the big fight in most countries, what's happening in China?
Yeah, China's having some real issues here. You know, they're kind of on the verge of deflation. And, you know, what deflation is where prices fall, which sounds great, but it's not good for an economy. Because when prices fall, so do government profits, or not government, sorry, so do company profits. And when, you know, company profits fall, companies cut jobs. you know, inflation in China was flat in July, but their producer price index was down for the ninth straight month. So it was down 5.4% year over year, and that's the lowest it's been in 7 years. So now we've got the, you know, Chinese central banks, you know, it's looking to load up on stimulus. But here, the real problem with deflation is that when prices are falling, consumers pull back on purchases because they see the prices are going down. So they go, well, maybe it'll go down even further. So we'll wait. So they hold off on these purchases, and that drop in spending kills the economy. You know, we have to remember that China is the second largest economy in the world. So if they slow down, the effects are going to be felt around the world. You know, one of the things that seems crazy to me is that China seems to be following in the footsteps of Japan, which has been in a deflationary spiral for over 20 years now. You know, Japan has a massive debt problem, and they've refused to address it. China seems to be following the same tact. So, you know, the solution that Japan had, and, you know, all these central banks always seem to come up with, is just add more and more stimulus. But we know that that does not boost spending. I mean, we saw it in North America here. We had all that quantitative easing for over 10 years. And, the central banks, they wanted to get inflation up to 1%, and they couldn't do it. So, I mean, all the money was went into the banks and went into the stock market. So deflation is a real problem. And when there's a lot of debt, it's a really big problem. And there's a lot of debt in China. So short term, I mean, if the central bank there, you know, if they pump a big stimulus package out there, that, you know, that's probably going to give the economy a bit of a boost. But longer term, that massive debt they got in China is going to be a problem.
What's your take on stocks right now?
Well, I mean, this week's been interesting. I just see that the market today on Friday here, it started off in the green, but just looking at it, as we get to the close, looks like it's going to drop off and hit the red again. I'm looking at a heat map right now, a one-week heat map of the S&P 500. And what that is, I think I mentioned this before, it's a map that shows all of the stocks on that. So 500 stocks, each stock gets a box. And then the size of the valuation of that stock is measured by the size of the box. And Jim, I always post the market notes on our blog at the trendletter.com, and I'll pop in any of these charts that we talk about today. So when I look at this chart right now, it's an awful lot of red on it right now. So, you know, we've had this huge run up in the market for the last, 6 months of the year. But it's been so oversold or overbought that we were really due for some kind of a correction. So, you know, hopefully this is going to be it, and we get some nice kind of cooling off and, get another decent buying opportunity. So we still got a problem. I mean, August and September are the pretty much the worst months for the markets. You know, according to the Stock Trader's Almanac, since 1987, August is the weakest month for the Dow and the second weakest for the S&P 500. And like I say, September is typically the second weakest month. And also we've had the surge in the bond yields, and that's a real problem for stocks. So if we look at market sentiment, and I think, again, last month I may have mentioned this. So the American Association of Individual Investors, so that's the AII, they do a survey every week, and they ask their members, what are your expectations that the stocks will rise over the next 6 months? Now, the historic average, bullish average, is 37%. Now, this survey was done on Tuesday and published on Wednesday. So it didn't incorporate, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, but it's that bullish sentiment is at 49%. And that's the second highest it's ever been. And so that is the ninth consecutive week it's been above that historic average. So clearly this group has been extremely bullish on the market. If we look at the CNN, the Fear and Greed Index, that incorporates those seven indicators. And that index right now is sitting at 74, which is a very high greed level. 75 kicks into extreme greed. So again, this is what seven different indicators are saying that this market is extremely heavily bought. So this is often a contrarian indicator, meaning it tends to show when we're close to tops. So we'll have to see if this market, this pullback here, has any legs. Now, another indicator that we like to look at is the put-call ratio. And that what that tells us is how much hedging insurance investors have. So up to now, up to this week, that ratio has been at an extremely low level, meaning investors were totally all in on the market. Risk on was the theme. But it's pulled back now, so what we're seeing is it's starting to rise a little bit. So again, that's telling us that investors have been so heavily invested, everybody's been on one side of the boat, that boat's getting awful tippy, so now they're starting to buy some of this insurance. So we'll see where this goes. So if we look at the big picture, the S&P 500 is still solidly in this long-term bull market it's been in since 2009. So despite the many bearish and recessionary signals, it's still got a very strong momentum in the markets. So again, we need to see what this week is going to mean, because up to now, the markets have been really climbing that wall of worry. So to test that initial uptrend line, so we're talking that, from 2009 right up to today, that solid uptrend line, if we want to test the bottom of that, we'd be looking at about the 4,000 level, which, today the S&P is at about 4,500. So that would be about an 11% decline from here. Now, our model is also looking at near-term to test the 4,250 level. So we will see. I mean, maybe this is just a little blip we've gone through this week and the markets continue higher. Or maybe, all of this enthusiasm and euphoria is kind of wearing down, and maybe now we start to take a break.
Gold managed to push through $2,000 last week, but then fell off. What do you see ahead for the precious metal?
Yeah, well, gold formed a base about 1950, 1920 level back in July, and that's held so far. So since then, gold's had a really nice rally off that base, but it was only able to break through and close above the 2000 resistance level for a very brief time last week. So a few weeks ago, we told our subscribers that we did not think that this was the big move for gold, and that we were looking for a near-term test at 2000 and then potentially have a great buying opportunity in mid to late August. So far that forecast is pretty much bang on. Like I said, we popped through 2000, but just ever so briefly, and now we've dropped down. I think we're at 1975 right now. So near-term resistance is at $2,000 level, then 2040, and then the previous all-time high at 2070. Next support we got is at 1915 to 1920, and then 1900, 1880, and then ultimately 1825, which was a solid, triple bottom, very strong support at that level. So gold's had has a very strong inverse correlation to the U.S. dollar. So we've seen the U.S. dollar rising recently. If that were to continue, that would be a problem for gold gaining traction. So, for us, for our model, ideally, we would get a drop back to that 1825, and that would trigger a great buying opportunity. I mean, ultimately, gold is going to rise as the confidence in governments collapse, and then people start to realize that these massive stimulus packages, these massive deficits, this massive printing of money is crushing our purchasing power.
When you were last on, you said you thought $83 would be the key resistance point for oil. Is that still your call?
Yeah, it is. I mean, so we're looking right now, oil's at 82.63. So the market's just closing. So 82.63, so that's pretty much looking at, where we projected the 83. So, I think that we are due for a pullback on oil. Oil and oil stocks have been the big exception over the last week where, the rest of the market sold off. But, these oil stocks and oil have done really well. So in oil, it continues to trade in this large range from, almost 8 months now, I guess it is, from the mid-60 level to that, $83 level. And like I say, we're right there right now. So this bullish action has been driven by the announcement of the August cuts by Saudi Arabia and Russia. And the whole goal there was to squeeze the short sellers. And it seems to have worked because oil had a real nice pop for that. So now just yesterday, or was it today, Saudi Arabia said that they are going to extend that cut and they may even expand it into September. So they're planning to expand it into September, but they're also looking to maybe extend and to go past the 1 million barrels that they were talking about. So we'll see if that's, these guys love to talk. It's really important to see what really happens here. So the real question here is, are these real cuts, or is this just more rhetoric to squeeze those short sellers? So, we've got, demand's thriving. We've got tightening across all the energy complex, and we think we're going to see further upside here for oil. But we also see that, like I said, it's around this $83-$84 range. We should see a top here soon, and we do need to see a pullback. So near-term support is sitting at the 50-day moving average, which right now is at 73.20, and the 200-day is at 76.80. So if oil drops back into that range and it holds there, so if 73.20 holds, then buying that dip would make a lot of sense. Now, in the bigger picture, we have a major support for oil at the $66 level. Now, you can say, well, what would knock oil down to those levels? So, we've talked about this a lot. We've got China's been struggling, as we talked about, potential deflation happening there. Now, of course, if they get the big stimulus package, that might negate that. But you've got Germany. Germany, the engine of Europe, is in a recession. And many of these other European countries are also close to a recession. So, that could certainly have a big, hit on demand. Also, we've got, all these geopolitical issues. So, escalation of tensions in Ukraine and Russia, which is certainly happening right now. We've got China and Russia, or it's China and U.S., are having all kinds of conflicts here, trade wars and all kinds of things. And then, of course, China-Taiwan. That's kind of the big one that we're worried about. So, if we get a recession, which we expect we probably will sometime early 2024, then that would certainly hit demand for oil. But if we look at the bigger picture, longer term, you got India and other emerging countries are expanding. They need more power. A lot of these places don't have power. So they're going to ramp up demand. China's going to have their stimulus package. Eventually, they're going to get out of it. China's a huge country. So those things on the demand side will pick up. And then if we look on the supply side, we've got the same story where capital expenditure in this sector is at, near record low, like it's 35, 40-year lows. So, and the reason for those lows is we've got, governments globally, they've got a hate on for fossil fuels. So they've increased, windfall taxes, they've increased regulations, and they've allowed no new permitting. So when you combine all of this, you create this huge supply problem over the next years. So we expect to see $100 oil for sure, very likely 150 and even higher in the next few years. And really, oil could be the big lead that ultimately brings all the other commodities up to, certainly copper would be one we'd pick up for sure.
You've been generally bullish on the U.S. dollar over the last few years. Is that still your take?
Well, the U.S. dollar, it peaked back in late September, and it's been in a downtrend ever since. It started to rally mid-July, and this week it actually broke out of that downtrend line. So, that's a small bullish indicator. We've got the Fed raising rates and good economic data generally from the U.S., and that's helped boost the U.S. dollar. But, right now, I'm not totally committed to the bullish side at this point. The U.S. dollar is sitting around the mid-102 level. It needs to break out past 103. The U.S. dollar weakness up to now has been due to the expectation that the ECB was going to be more aggressive on their rates than the Fed. But again, last week, we actually saw the ECB back off of these kind of comments, especially given that Germany, as they say, the engine of the EU economy, they're in a recession. So there's a very good chance the ECB is going to have to back off their rate hikes. So if they did, and the U.S. keeps, stays put or even raises those, well, then obviously the U.S. dollar would rise. So right now, we're just watching the numbers. We need to see the U.S. dollar push through 103 to gain any traction. I'm not so sure that's going to happen on this cycle.
What about the Canadian dollar?
Well, since October, the Canadian dollar has been trading in a range of about 72 on the low end and 76 on the high. Today, it's testing right near the, its near-term support at around the 75-cent level. And so that needs to hold. If it doesn't, then the Canadian dollar is going to probably drop further. So the Canadian dollar has been falling this week along with most of the commodities. But again, the oil side of things has actually gone the other way. So the Canadian dollar, though, it's dropped down, and primarily because of the U.S. dollar. So we see that the the commodities, oil's been the exception. So bottom line is the Canadian dollar, like most currencies, is heavily influenced by the U.S. dollar. So again, we're testing that near-term support around 75. If that does not hold, then 73 is going to be the next support level for the Canuck buck.
Martin, where can people find out more about your newsletter?
Well, they can go to, the site is called, is at The Trend Letter. So all one word, thetrendletter.com. They can email us at info@thetrendletter.com. We've got, three services. We've got the Trend Letter. So that's, publishes every Sunday, covers, equities, currencies, precious metals, commodities, bonds. So that's for investors who want to understand what's driving the markets. We have Trend Technical Trader. So originally a hedging service, but also now does long positions. And that includes our gold technical indicator. So the audience there is for generally more active investors, but long-term investors can also benefit, and especially from those hedging strategies. And then the third service is our Trend Disruptors. So that's very speculative into the artificial intelligence, virtual reality, augmented reality, cloud, 5G. So audience there, people that want to speculate, but should only do it with risk capital that they can afford to lose. Now, the other thing, Jim, we have is we have our headline service, and it's a free service. Yes, free. And what we do there is every day during the week, we review what's happening in the markets that morning. And then we send out headlines to our subscribers. And basically, it's what we think every investor should be reading and should understand what's going on in the markets in that area. So readers can then just simply read the headlines. And if they want more detail, they can just simply click on the link and read the article. So, yeah, so that's it. And, yeah, if you've got any questions, just contact us at info@thetrendletter.com.
Martin, thank you so much for being on This Week in Money.
My pleasure, Jim. Have a great weekend.
My guest has been Martin Straith, founder of Trend News Online at thetrendletter.com. And that wraps up our show for this week. We'd like to thank our guests, Ross Clark, Rick Ackerman, and Martin Straith. And thank you for listening. If you have any questions for the show or for our guests, you can send them to info@howstreet.com. I'm Jim Goddard. We'll be back next week with more This Week in Money.
Comments made on This Week in Money are an expression of opinion only and should not be construed in any manner whatsoever as recommendations to buy or sell any financial instrument at any time. Archived online at talkdigitalnetwork.com. This Week in Money is a production of How Street Media Incorporated. Executive producer is Tom Allen.